Good morning, everyone. Right, okay, welcome back. I want to call the Customer Service and Operations and Security Committee to order. Before us, we have the agenda. Any objections to the agenda today? Hearing none, we accept it. May I have a motion to approve the minutes? Mr. Bulger moves.
Second.
Second by Mr. Lavi. Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor? And opposed? Thank you very much. We have a short agenda, but an important agenda today, and I want to begin first by doing the safety, and then we'll go into that part.
Good morning. In the case of an emergency, we're going to egress through the main doors. There's also additional exits behind me. We're going to assemble at the lawn at the National Building Museum across the street. There are automatic external defibrillators available behind the guard station. Fire extinguishers are strategically located throughout the building. Restrooms are past the guard desk on the left. September is National Preparedness Month, and FEMA recommends focusing on personal planning with the overarching theme, disasters, don't plan ahead, you can. So I'd like to show a short video.
Don't wait. Communicate. Make your emergency plan today.
So one of the most important things FEMA recommends for households is to make an emergency plan. Your family may not be together if a disaster strikes. Take into consideration how you'll contact one another and reconnect if separated. Also, establishing a family meeting place that's familiar and easy to find. The first step to putting a plan together is to discuss the following four questions with your family, friends, and household. One, how will I receive emergency alerts and warnings? Two, what is my shelter plan? Three, what is my evacuation route? And four, what is my family household communication plan? For more information on how to prepare your family and community, visit the ready.gov homepage, and the website is up above. All right, thank you.
Thank you very much. Very timely information and important for us all. Today's agenda consists of two items. One's an administrative approval, and the other is a non-approval. We're moving forward. Jim Emery is going to present to us the updated Metro bus fleet, and this plan is to be submitted to the FTA, and it provides the foundation of managing our replacement bus fleet and rehabilitations of our facilities. The next one is the public safety item. Mr. Paddock will bring us up to date on Metro's semiannual security report, and the report measures our crime in the Metro system as part of the Metro key performance indicators, and or the KPIs as we manage them. As the chief's report will show, there has been significant decrease in Part 1 in violent crimes in the Metro system. So we look forward to those two items, and we'll start with Ms. Embry, who's on the action item.
All right. Good morning, everyone. I'm very pleased to be able to present to you the move on to the next slide, present the recommendations for your adoption of the Metro Bus Fleet Management Plan for 2017. The FTA requires a fleet management plan to correspond with various milestones in transit life, expansion of service, procurement of buses, addition of new facilities. And so we're at the cusp of entering into a new procurement process, and so we revised the plan for that purpose. There are no funding commitments as a part of this plan. This is laying out the parameters for which then the future funding discussions will take place. As part of the process of the fleet plan, we essentially are looking at how the fleet's used, justifying the size of the fleet, justifying the maintenance and preservation of the fleet, documenting the size required to meet the demands, looking to ensure that the federal grant is being used efficiently and effectively. And we have gone through a multi-year process engaging the local governments as well as different agency departments within WMATA to prepare a consensus recommendation. Next slide. So just as a background for Metrobus, we currently operate 169 lines of service, 10,700 bus stops, give or take. We have a fleet of 1,583, and currently 1,249 are used at the peak period. We had 122 million riders, which represent about 70% of all bus riders in the Washington National Capital Region. Right now we have 9 divisions, 4 that are located in the district, 2 that are in, 3 in Maryland, 2 in Virginia, and we've got 2 divisions that are currently under construction. This is a map representing the dispersal of our divisions. You can see they're widely distributed across the region, from West Ox on the far west to Landover on the east, and from what will be Cinderbed on the south all the way up to Montgomery Division. So that covers a lot of the region. Key, of course, is the relationship to our services, and the divisions that are closer to the core obviously have more service associated with them. Next. This table is a summary of each of the divisions, representing their age, representing the size and capacity, the fuel type as a referral. And I would point out that we're now celebrating the 110th anniversary of the Northern Division. Doing a quick calculation, about 1.5 billion people have ridden on streetcars and buses that have come from that division. It's one of the topics for the future because obviously I think we've life-cycled that facility sufficiently, and they'll be talking about how we go about replacing it. Next. Our fleet, our target has been to have a fleet that's 7.5 years in age. 15 years is the life cycle of our buses. We're very pleased that right now our fleet age is 7.05, so we're actually ahead of the mark. It's one of the best fleets that this agency's ever fielded. We're very proud of it. We have 90% of our buses are the standard 40-foot coaches, and we do have a fleet of 67 articulated, the 60-foot coaches, to support. And fuel technology, we've gotten to almost 60% of our fleet is a hybrid electric diesel bus. With compressed natural gas, it's just under 30%. Going on. Over the course of the last 5 years, we've purchased 510 buses that have been delivered. There are another 20 coming, representing a fairly significant investment in that fleet. One of the issues that we've dealt with is that the vendor changed. The original award went to North American Bus Industries, and they were taken over by New Flyer Corporation, and so there was a novation agreement and the vendor changed, and the competition in this industry for heavy-duty transit buses is relatively small. The fleet performance is part of what we look at during the study. Over the course of the last 5 years, we've significantly improved the mean distance between failures, the maintenance metric, as you can see by the blue table. Despite the increase in the need for maintenance campaigns and supportive rail shuttles and other things that weren't part of the plan last time, we've done, I think, a remarkable job. We did complete a couple capital projects, building a new body shop and paint shop at Carmen Turner and a new service and storage facility at Landover Division. Those have significantly improved our capabilities and efficiencies. And we've done 100 buses a year consistently for our midlife overhaul program, which is a critical part of maintaining that improved performance. And as mentioned before, we reduced the average age of the fleet. Depending on the number of buses you buy each year, it sort of fluctuates. But our goal is to have it be at 7.5 or below and to be evenly distributed across the 3 states. And as Mr. Wynn presented last month in the Title VI report, we've been very successful in accomplishing that. The fleet demand is driven by the ridership, and our ridership is very peak-oriented. 65% of our Metrobus riders ride during the a.m. and p.m. peak periods, but that also means 35% are riding in off-peak periods, which is a pretty good demand. In our analysis, we've identified that to achieve the standard performance for state of good operations in terms of on-time performance and capacity, we could justify another 117 buses across the whole system to accomplish that. One way to provide additional capacity would be to look at expanding the articulated bus fleet, but right now we're constrained in our capacity to maintain and to store those buses. And there are about 147 buses identified in various plans for expansion projects should funding come along. The purpose of this is just to document that the fleet we have is minimally required, that if opportunity came along, we could justify additional buses. That justifies at least maintaining the fleet that we have. And the bottom graph that we have there just shows that although we do see trends of increase and decrease in ridership on Metrobus, when you look at it over a number of years, it's actually fairly stable. Our riders come every day. Next. One of the activities we go through with each preparing for each procurement is a review of the alternative fuel policy. Back in May of 2000, the Metro Board hosted a workshop on alternative fuel technologies. We had the best minds in the industry, the best minds in representatives from each of the fuel technologies, and lots of strong advocates in the room here to come up with to review all of the merits of clean air and fuel sustainability. And I came up with a policy that really says that we should focus on using proven technologies. Let others be on the bleeding edge of technology, but our goal is to be effective and efficient, but to reduce emissions wherever we can. Back then, compressed natural gas and ultra-low sulfur diesel fuel were identified as the most viable and effective technologies, and that guide is applied to each procurement. As a result of that discussion, the board approved creating two fleets of compressed natural gas powered buses, one at Bladensburg, one at 4 Mile. We're actually in the process of replacing that fleet. They've life cycled out, and they have, I think, collectively served something around a billion customers between those two divisions. So it's been a major contribution. And then additionally, once those two facilities were filled with buses, we've been buying the diesel electric hybrid. And moving on to the next slide. So we maintain a contract with West Virginia University to actually come on property every year and do a test of our buses to verify that the real buses are actually performing the way the engineered and designed buses were intended to be. So we have a 15-year record of the history of the performance of our different fleets. And as I mentioned, we have 461 natural gas buses, 922 of the hybrids. And through this process, we've managed to significantly improve our fuel economy as well as make tons and tons of contribution to meeting the NOx and VOx clean air goals of the Washington region. Next. One emerging technology is the electric bus. The District of Columbia has bought a few, and we have one bus that we got from the New Flyer manufacturer as a test bus. Right now it's operating based out of the Western Division up in Northwest DC on the M4N4 E6, and sometimes we run a 33 all the way to downtown. Right now because we're unfamiliar with the technology, we're in a one-year pilot to see how reliable is it, how maintainable is it safe. There's a whole list of metrics that will go with that, and we will be reporting out after the 12-month period to seek further guidance as to whether that it has a role in the future. But one of the constraints is that we would need to do a major power source upgrade at each of the facilities that would host an electric bus. Just like with compressed natural gas, you've got to provide the juice, and none of our divisions have that capability in their current configuration. Next. So as we prepare our five-year fleet, and we've applied the technology guidelines, we are looking to, we also reviewed the performance of the next generation, the new generation diesel equipment. It is now, with the new style motors and the post-emissions cleanup equipment, it's performing at the particulate, the VOX and the NOx of compressed natural gas and the diesel-electric hybrid. We found through our own experience that the life cycle cost of hybrid is actually more expensive than the clean diesel technology. Potentially, you can save money in the acquisition of the fleet and then ongoing maintenance because it's less complex and doesn't require replacement of batteries and all of the dual energy sources can be less costly. So the conclusion is that there's substantial life cycle savings associated with replacing the hybrids as they age out with a clean diesel bus. Next. So as part of our final recommendations for the plan, first off, we go ahead and continue with the plan to have 10 divisions. When Andrews Federal Center and Cinderbed open, then the Southern Avenue would close and ultimate configuration would be 10 divisions. We would maintain the spare ratio within the FTA guideline, which is 20%. We would continue the midlife maintenance programs that maintenance has created, demonstrating that they're effective and efficient. Increase the number of articulated buses within the capacity that we have in the garages. Purchase clean diesel-powered buses as a replacement for hybrids as they age out. Install a compressed natural gas fueling station at Shepherd Parkway. We're under contract with Washington Gas to do that by the end of next year. And that would increase our capability to have additional compressed natural gas buses in the future. And as part of the procurement, we are reserving an option to buy additional buses and buy additional articulated coaches should demand come in the future. Right now, the purchase rules have changed, so you can't go leverage off of Atlantis contract or something, so we have to provide all of that within our own procurement. Next. So one of the dialogue elements in this plan is the fact that buses need a place to live. They need a facility to support them. And we're in the process of developing a final facilities plan, but projects we have currently, Cinderbed down in southern Fairfax County is close to opening. Andrews Federal Center is, construction is moving quickly over by the Air Force Base. Shepherd Parkway, as I mentioned, the compressed natural gas is coming, and we need to begin to look at developing a replacement strategy for Northern and Bladensburg, as both of those facilities are at a life cycle where they really need to be replaced to be more efficient, to be more effective, to provide the capacity, and to provide a better working environment. We also look at the future facility needs. Western Division up in Northwest and Friendship Heights area is very well located for serving our transit market. We've been discussing for as long as I can remember being part of a joint development project. Right now that facility is in a state of good repair and can wait for the opportunity, but we recommend retaining that location for future operations. 4 Mile Run has come to the point where we need to replace the compressed natural gas fueling station. It's life cycled out along with that fleet. Montgomery County, Montgomery Division up in Montgomery County off of Rockville Pike is set for some renovations similar to what we completed at Landover. Southern Avenue, the recommendation is we continue to operate it for at least another 10 years to provide bridge space so we can attend to the construction needs of Northern and Bladensburg. And then as we look into the far future and trying to find opportunities for efficiencies, one of the issues with our new garage locations is that they're farther away from our services than the old garages. And so deadhead becomes an important element in the cost equation. If we can locate a garage to reduce deadhead, that makes us more efficient. And one of the opportunities is in the Silver Spring area. The garage is over on Rockville Pike, and the services are over on Georgia Avenue. If we can find a location in that area, we could be more efficient. Montgomery County is similarly looking for a new garage location, so as we plan for the future, there may be an opportunity for a co-location similar to what we do with Fairfax Connector that would be of benefit to both of us. And then as we go forward, there's in the fiscal 18 and the six-year plan of capital improvements, there's a number of resources that are identified for the fleet and to complete Cinderbed and Andrews Federal Center and the Shepherd Parkway Natural Gas, but there is not funding identified yet for Bladensburg and Northern and those future projects. So that would be part of what we would define in the facility plan. Next. So the next steps, today we're here presenting to the committee for recommendation to the board to adopt this plan, and then I would transmit that to FTA as part of our ongoing documentation of the procurement process. The procurement would begin, and it includes a base of 100 buses a year as replacements with options for 10 articulated buses and 20 standards, either as a replacement for an existing bus or as an expansion. By the end of 2017, I mentioned we'll complete the plan. Cinderbed, Andrews, Federal will all open in the next year, and the funding decisions will come to the board as part of the discussions around the capital improvement program. So the recommendation is to approve this plan as guidance for moving forward with the procurement and maintenance of our fleet.
Thank you, Mr. Henry. You've heard the presentation. Do we have any questions?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Jim, thanks for the report. I've got some concerns that I'd want to go address with you. How many articulated buses can we handle at Shepherd Park? And that leads into another series of questions about articulated buses.
I was looking forward to that. Yeah, Shepherd Parkway has capability for 60 buses, 60 articulated coaches.
All right. And are we maxed out at Shepherd Park? I remember going to the opening, and I remember being down there when we cut the ribbon.
We are not maxed out. We do have 10 articulated buses ordered for delivery next year, and the intent is that they would be assigned to Shepherd Parkway to support some of the services coming out of that division.
Okay, the district has some concerns that we're not buying enough articulated buses for our busiest corridors, and I'm sure you're aware of that. Particularly on 16th Street, which I notice every day.
Yeah, there's at least 10 lines that would benefit from using articulated coaches, and 16th, 14th, Georgia Avenue, H Street, the 90 line, the A line in Southeast, the Y's, the C's, the Q's. Arlington's been talking about them on Columbia. Pike. And so, yeah, there's great opportunity. Three constraints. One, what we're finding is that the articulated coaches, although they can be more cost effective, ultimately it's not a big difference.
Really?
When you look at the individual capacity constraints. And to really take advantage of them, you would have to reduce the frequency of buses. So there's a consumer design aspect to, you know, is it better to have four large buses an hour or six smaller buses? That's the difference between a 10-minute headway and a 15-minute headway. And so there's a balance. I think on 16th Street, our goal is to get to where we can have all of the base buses be articulateds, the ones that stay out all day and then use 40-foots for the peak hour supplements. Our problem there is that Northern Division does not have space to be able to house those buses.
And articulated? Or
yeah. Well, they've got 21 articulated, but that facility is essentially at maximum capacity.
Yeah. Ancient.
And so to put a bus down at Shepherd and run it all the way up to Silver Spring to start an S line would be quite expensive. And so we've been, that's one of the drivers toward wanting to rebuild the Northern Division to provide more maintenance capability and therefore capacity to support the articulated fleet on Georgia Avenue, on 14th Street, and on 16th, especially.
Madam Chair, I have some other questions, but I'll defer to other colleagues.
Thank you, Mr. Lavi.
Thank you. Thanks for the presentation. Very interesting. I wanted just to understand the issues with hybrid buses. Is it just the cost of maintaining those buses that's different from the clean diesel?
For example, in our study, our hybrid fleet was costing $1.74 a mile to operate, and the clean diesel was $1.52. The clean diesel fleet does not require at midlife a replacement of the batteries and the electrical work, and then the cost savings is something on the order of 20% to 25% on initial procurement.
Two other short questions. Is the industry, is the transit industry reaching the same conclusions? I mean, are they reaching the same conclusions in Chicago and New York and everywhere else?
Well, of course, every situation is unique, but yes, as financial pressures have come to bear, we've been selecting more efficient and lower cost rather than continuing some of the balanced energies, although there's a lot of investment in compressed natural gas in various cities, and so they're continuing those fleets. Los Angeles just recently made a big investment in electric buses, so we're hoping that they'll have success and we can learn from their lessons.
So the investments we've made in hybrid, in training of people to maintain it and facilities, this type of stuff, this will be translated over to take care of CNG and clean diesel?
Well, because the hybrid bus has a diesel system in it, all of that skill for maintenance is needed for either type of bus. It's the addition of the knowledge of the batteries and the electrical that has been a challenge for our maintenance staff to address. By no means we're taking issue with the performance. The hybrid fleet has been very reliable. It's been very efficient, but to keep it running has cost us more money in the long run than equivalent clean diesel buses.
Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Goldman.
Thank you, Mr. Augustine. I'll defer to his questions. Mr. Hammond, thank you for your presentation. The questions that Mr. Lalby and Mr. Bolger asked you actually could segue to the questions that I was going to ask you. First, I wanted to turn to your slide on fleet composition. I don't know if we can dig that up. Excuse me, we've had some discussion of articulated buses. I guess I wanted to start with some definitional questions. What are the seat sizes for when you refer to standard buses, small buses, and articulated buses? What are we talking about?
Well, the way we define it is the 60-foot bus is the articulated bus, the one with the accordion in the middle. Yeah. It has 60 seats. It would, as a design standard, be able to accommodate 72 people, because our standard is 1.2 load factor, so 60 seats, 72 with 12 standees. In reality, you can easily get far above that and do on a regular basis. The standard coach is 40 seats. We buy low floor buses, and they can generally handle 8 to 10 standees with comfort. And then our maintenance staff calls anything smaller than 40 a small bus.
All right, and so what sort of the average seats?
37, 35s, and 30s.
I'm sorry, 30, 35s?
37, 35, and 30s. Those are the small bus fleet.
And just continuing the definitional exercise on the pie chart, I think we've talked a little bit about hybrid, and I think the concept of hybrid is similar to my Toyota Prius, in that it basically
yes.
concept. But could you just differentiate what's the difference between standard diesel and clean diesel?
They're different technologies. The standard diesel are our oldest buses. They are 15 to 17 years old. They were compliant with clean air requirements when they were manufactured in 2001. The clean diesel technology has, in addition to a refined and efficient motor, it has an emissions scrubbing system that goes with it, similar to the catalytic converter on your car, that pulls the particulate matters out, that burns up all the NOx and VOx and makes sure that the emissions are as clean as possible.
So if you were buying a diesel bus today, you would only buy clean diesel?
Yes.
You wouldn't buy standard
yeah,
diesel?
The standard no longer is manufactured.
Now, again, on the pie chart, we talked a little bit about electric buses, and there's obviously no pie slice here for electric buses, and you indicated that there's a test period that you're going through, and when will that test be finished, and when will you be coming back with some analysis on electric buses?
September, I think it'd be June of next year would be the conclusion, so by this time next year we would have a report.
And if we were looking at this chart, pie chart, 5 years from now, would we have a slice for electric buses?
Probably, if the technology can get reliable.
Yes.
You know, in the Washington region, we've toyed with electric buses ever since George was created for Falls Church. And what failed was the steering and the mechanical aspects of it, not the electrical technology. So part of it is getting the right technology with the right bus so that you can have an effective product. We're very intrigued by what DC Circulator is going to experience mm-hmm. and hope to learn a lot from their experience with buying a New Flyer electric bus and the Proterra. Anyway, we'll learn from their lesson.
You pointed out that one of the concerns or problems with electric buses is you need a new power source at various
yes.
garages. What are the other trade-offs? Are electric buses more expensive than the diesel or hybrid that you have up there?
Well, that's what we're sort of waiting to see. We didn't actually have to pay for the bus we have.
I
it was given as a settlement to the procurement contract. And so we'll see what the life of the battery. That's one of our concerns is how often do you have to replace the batteries, because those are very expensive components. The rest of the bus is pretty much a standard cost for a bus.
I just wanted to ask you a question or two on the chart that called about fleet demand. I don't know if we can get that up there. You've got, in the second bullet, fleet demand, it's number 16 in my series. There it is.
Right there.
In your second bullet, you've got a slide statement saying that demand exceeds capacity, and you could use 117 buses to achieve mm-hmm. standards. And then in the fourth bullet, you say that 147 buses are needed for planning growth. Does the 147 include the 117, or is that a separate group of buses?
I think you could take them to be two separate items. So there's a collective deficiency of, over 250, if you look at potential demand for fleet.
Right, and so the 147 is based on an assumption of growth?
Yeah, we have done 60 quarter and service evaluation studies of our services, and within those studies we've identified future strategic opportunities and investments, and so collectively from that body of work, we've been able to identify 147 buses worth of projects.
Now, in the Finance Committee today, Mr. Anasecki will point out that the bus ridership actually fell 4% last year compared to the prior year, FY16. So were those studies done before the results of last year's ridership numbers were available, or had you taken into account the ridership decline last year in projecting a need for 147 more buses?
Well, the studies have been done over the past decade.
Okay.
So they're designed to look at the service and the product development, if you will. We did most of this analysis based on fiscal 15 ridership data, but as part of bringing it up to date, we looked at what's happened with ridership since counting fiscal 15 through fiscal 17, and what we found is that even though there's been a decrease in ridership, it averages out to be about 4 riders per trip, which isn't enough to cause us to not run that bus. That where the ridership declines have been the biggest are on our services that have a policy frequency and not a demand-driven frequency, so it wouldn't change the number of buses. The number of services that we operate, we did discontinue, I think it was 6 lines of service as part of the fiscal 18 budget process. Even accounting for those buses no longer being needed, because of the need to provide rail shuttle fleet and to deal with our midlife overhaul and other fleet campaigns, within the context of the FTA guidelines and what makes sense for efficiently managing our fleet, we still need those buses.
I guess my concern here is just looking at your bus ridership history, it doesn't exactly show robust growth over that period. So taking into consideration the decline, I'm sort of concerned as to what the basis is for a need for an additional 147 buses.
Well, it's a planning recommendation and not funded in any way. But also, if we were a steady state, I think you would see that line increase more over time. However, during this period, there have been transfers of services to local operations, and so it's not always a steady state, but in general, the bus system is not terribly responsive to inelastic, I guess would be the term,
yes.
In terms of ridership.
I just have one question on something you said. You referred to this FTA spare bus ratio, 20%. Does that mean that for every 4 buses on the street, you have 1 bus in reserve? Is that what a spare ratio means in this industry?
Every 5 buses, we'd have 0.85 buses in reserve.
So they basically stay in the garages.
Well, you size your fleet to be 15% larger than you need for your peak vehicle requirement, and then all the buses cycle through services on
it. Right, so that assumes some maintenance too for that.
You don't have a bus assigned to just one line. It's changes depending on the maintenance cycle. This bus will be ready today. That bus will be ready tomorrow. For preventive maintenance, we cycle the buses through, and so it's a collective performance and not an line-based.
And you find that a good standard, the FAA?
Yeah, we're actually less than most of our peers.
Yeah.
We've been operating at a 15.6% for the last 15 or 20 years. But what we are finding is because of the requirements for the midlife, for the fleet campaigns, for the support of the rail services, that we need to nudge that up a couple of points to provide enough buses so we have them ready when they're needed to go out on service.
Well, thank you. I'll be looking forward to your report on electric buses next year,
thanks,
as well as your budget projections later this year. Thank you.
I think we need to go on to the next item. Is that one that we can offer offline? Would you?
Excuse me, Manager?
I was thinking we could move on to the next item if your question
no,
is
No, I had
not
another
urgent.
Question. I didn't realize that my colleague
well, I,
was
I
going
didn't
to
either,
ask
but
20
that's,
questions.
That's why
that's
we're trying
why
to
I
move
deferred.
On.
Okay, here's the question.
In,
are you guys proposing to change the board policy adopted on fuel propulsion goals of 50% clean diesel and 50% CNG, subject to garage capacity?
No, we are not.
Oh, good.
In fact, the addition of Shepherd Parkway gives us the capability to get to close to 750 compressed natural gas powered buses in the future. We can't do that over the course of the next 5 years because of the capacity constraints associated with trying to rebuild Bladensburg and address Northern. But in the second half of the decade, it may be possible that we could start increasing the size of our compressed natural gas fleet.
Well, that's good to know. Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Embry. We have an item that's moving for action. Do we have a motion on the table? Okay. Is there a second?
Second.
Okay. Is there a debate? Hearing none. All those in favor, we move the action to move forward for approval of the Metro Fleet Plan, and that moves to the board. All those in, we've gotten a vote.
Aye.
And opposed. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Danbury. And we'll move on to the public safety. Mr. Pavlik, thank you with the item.
Yep. Good morning, Ms. Hudgens and members of the board. I'm here today to talk about the six-month crime report for the last 6 months in comparison to 2016. Just to kind of put it in reduction, 17% reduction overall in Part 1 crimes. With this equates to, on the rail side, about 3.8 per million riders. When we break that down, we look at bus as well as parking lots and garages. We've seen some slight increases in bus-related crimes as well as parking lots. They're both hovering about 2 crimes per million riders. When we put this into context a little bit, yesterday the annual COG report came out, and it's a little premature to equate, you know, Metro to the entire region, but the region is also seeing some crime reductions, and the region experienced about 20 crimes per 1,000 people. We're averaging about 3.8 crimes per million people. So just to put that in a little bit into context. What's driving this number down is we've really honed in the last 6 months on the CompStat model policing. You know, we have a finite number of resources. We've made some leadership changes in the police department, really getting our crime analytical people really involved in crime analysis and where that crime is occurring, and trying to get to a predictive policing, a preactive instead of reactive policing. But where is the crime occurring? Where is those trends happening at? And really mapping that out and deploying those resources accordingly. We also rely very heavily this year on our digital unit, the camera unit. This authority has made a great investment in camera technology, whether on the 7Ks, whether on every bus, the rail stations. Our federal partners have given us a lot of grant money to maintain cameras and invest in camera technology, and, you know, using Dan and media relations in that group, really, you know, telling our story on what's happening. And if you commit a crime in Metro on a bus or a rail car, depending on the series, you know, we're going to catch you on camera, we're going to catch you. So that technology and the way we're deploying our resources is really driving this number down. When we start looking at Part 1 crime, we break it down really into two categories, property crime and crimes against persons. Traditionally, your property crime is predominantly or mostly theft-related charges or theft-related events. We're seeing about a 10% reduction overall in property-related crime. And again, to put into context, Part 1 crime, about almost 70% of our Part 1 crime is property-related. So there's not more crime against people. It's more obviously property-related. Stolen bikes is something we continue to really drive home. We estimate, you know, we park thousands of bikes a day throughout the rail system, and how do we safeguard them? We continue to push a bike registration program. This year we're trying a new tactic is we will actually issue a fraud prevention sticker where that sticker correlates to you, and in that way, if your bike is stolen, we'll be able to recover it or have a means to at least recover it, because what happens is most people don't know the serial number, even color of their bike sometimes. It's unfortunate, but it's no difference if your home was burglarized, heaven forbid, and they ripped your TV off the wall. The police are going to ask you for the serial number, make and model of your TV, and no one really knows that. And we're finding that with bike riders. So we've created a system, a database, where you will register your bike with the transit police. We will have your serial number. We know your make and model. So if we see that bike on a website or a pawn database, we'll at least have an avenue to recover that. And we anticipate that number is going to continue to come down. The theft snatch, cell phones, we saw about a 7% reduction there so far this year. And we think that's just good awareness. You know, you look at how the marketing and how you purchase a cell phone now is very expensive, to say the least. And I think people are finally realizing the cost of that cell phone and what it means to them. A lot of awareness campaigns that we continue to push with our riders and the cost of the cell phones and those data plans and all that, where people are really paying attention to their cell phone device now. Parking lot crime, a slight, you know, increases there. And what we're seeing with parking lot-related vehicle crime is it comes in peaks and valleys. So we might get hit at one particular location for 10 or 12 incidents in one day, and then it goes away. The concern there, we've seen a slight uptick in parking, the handicap placards. We went through that about 2 years ago. We made a couple arrests with that. Seen a slight increase in that in this year. And the challenge with that in law enforcement in the region seeing it is you have to display it in order to park. So that's something that we're going to continue to work on. I want to talk a little bit about fare evasion. We've really put a hard effort into fare evasion this year, really focusing on that. And it kind of equates to the broken windows theory of policing. If you pay attention to the little stuff, then the bigger crimes won't happen. This is just a lot of good enforcement efforts by the men and women of the police department. We think almost 7,000 criminal citations this year, over 2,000 warnings. And about 50% of our arrests so far this year relate directly to fare evasion. So we're going to continue with this, focusing on key routes within the bus and rail system, working with our station managers, their station manager direct, where is this fare evasion occurring. And the other step we're doing here is really focusing on the DC-1 card as well and sharing every day, daily numbers where we're still challenged with certain stations. We share video snippets with the DC Mayor of Education Group and her staff, showing where we still have a large number of youth using the swing gates. So we're going to continue to focus that, identify the schools, so that way we can get our kids to tap. Earlier this morning, we released a press release, and it kind of goes to how important it is to tap. On August 30th, we had a woman who tried to compromise two young riders on one of our buses. Long story short, some great passengers intervened. When the young girl got to school, she reported to her staff, and it took us a little time to wind that back and find out what bus she was on, to pull the video, to identify the individual involved, et cetera, et cetera. But if she had tapped, it would have made our lives a lot easier. The story ended up very well. The child was unharmed. She was subsequently, the suspect in this case, was subsequently stopped by Metropolitan Police last night for another offense, and she came back wanted on the warrant we had for her arrest. So it ended well, but it just goes to show how important it is for law enforcement, because it's another tool to account for our young people if and when they're using our rail or bus system. When we look at Part 1 crimes against person, these are traditionally your more violent crimes or crimes of that could be an aggravated level. We're seeing some good increases there, decreases there as well, about 25%, with some great reductions there. And again, it goes back to just the way we're honing in on crime data. Our intelligence information that's coming in from crime analysis is really telling us where to put the cops on the dots and using that CompStat model policing, and it's just having great effects with us. Metropolitan Police is one of our biggest partners, and their commitment that Chief Newsom's made us is he has someone from his team sit in our SOC every night, because we know our crimes share each other's jurisdictions and challenges there. Most of the robberies and things we're seeing on this side of the on persons, crimes against persons, happening in the rail stations on trains. The Font Plaza comes on the radar screen a lot, but what happens is the crime occurs aboard the train, but they get off at La Font Plaza and report it. So that's where we're going down and really drilling into the crime, where La Font Plaza may be the reporting location, but the crime actually occurred, the crime occurred aboard a train. So we're starting to see some good decreases there as well. I want to talk a little bit about bus operator assaults. Although it's not a Part 1 offense, it's something that's near and dear to all of us. We have seen a slight increase here, about a 20%. And when you look at the numbers, when we compare this time last year, we were 34 and we're at 41 respectfully. So it's a partnership that we're continuing to do with our bus operators. We've had some obviously sensational video here over the last couple months with the events that have occurred. We continue to use bus shields, the camera technology I can't say enough about on the buses, the training opportunities. We now have a joint labor management task force that Mr. Leader's chairing in partnership Ms. Jackie Jeter and the police department and Pat Lavin from safety to really focus on bus operator assaults and how we can better address them. And part two to that is really drilling out what is causing this argument. So we try to break that down and really get an understanding what is the root cause of why these operators are being assaulted. And about 50%, either from fare evasion or fare dispute or some type of a verbal dispute. And then there's some, it's the mental health issues where, unfortunately, there's nothing law enforcement, you know, it's more of a public society or social services issue. And then you look at, well, what is the type of assault that is occurring? Most cases, they're expectorated on, food thrown on them or poured on them or some type of object. We're very pleased to report that it's not violent, but it's still an assault at the end of the day. And, you know, one thing we were trying to stress to, you know, the U.S. Attorney's Office and other jurisdictions is the safety of the employee is one thing, but it's also the safety of everybody else on that bus. And God forbid they lose control of that bus or something else happens, and now you put a whole bunch of lives in jeopardy. So, you know, we're very confident with this new joint labor task force that we're doing with labor and management under Mr. Leader's leadership, and that number we're going to continue to drive down and really focus on training. And then lastly, I want to talk a little bit about sexual harassment. You see the reporting numbers up, but the actual crime numbers down. We like to believe it's through our efforts and outreach, again, going relying on Dan and social media and the media to help us tell our story. And we think when people are experiencing that unwanted, those lewd comments, suggestions, that are, you know, the population's tired of and they're finally reporting to the police department and they're feeling comfortable reporting it. I think also when we have our cases like indecent exposure and things like that, and we make the arrest and we go to the media and say, hey, this is what's happening, we're making the arrest, it's making women and victims more likely to report it. So although the reporting numbers out, the crime side's coming down. I just want to talk a little bit about the criminal non-sexual. So this would be an incident where it's a simple assault. So it may be I assaulted you, but it wasn't in a sexual nature. So that's why we break this down, and this is through the web portal only. So we're just trying to show, and, you know, thank God we got a great relationship with CAS, the Collective Action for Safe Spaces, and how that partnership works, but really being transparent to the community and trying to share as much information as we can and encourage people to report it when they experience those type of behaviors. And that pretty much sums it up, ma'am. I'll take any questions you have.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Pavlik, and it's a very good report in terms of progress, but there are those challenges that we have out there. And I want to thank, I think you and Mr. Wiedefeld, in terms of referencing with the bus driver incident, that the work that we've been doing with the youth has really paid off for us. They're getting the message of that this is a transport that you need to respect and watch your conduct and those kinds of things and build a relationship actually in doing that. So hopefully we can get to something that can make some ridership relationships in that way. We know that all folks that are riding are not being abusive or the like, but in this place where we're finding that, what things can we do to kind of encourage someone that might want to open up and say, we want to recognize the bus driver as a very critical and essential person to this trip, so thus we need to treat that people though respectfully in that way. So
thank you.
I think it's a good start for us. Let me see if there are other questions. Still, Bobby.
Thank you, Chief. You know, very good report. I've really been impressed with the way that WMATA has been able to respond to some of the serious incidents that we've had lately. With that said, one of the disadvantages of being a board member at DOT is that unlike the WMATA complaint department. So, unfortunately, a member of my staff was on a red line train on September 6th and was a victim of a pickpocket. And on one of the new 7,000 cars, two men got on the train at the last minute, held the doors open, went in, crowded train where they bumped up against everyone, started a little tussle and argument in there while they were running into people, and managed to pickpocket the gentleman's wallet. So I just have a couple of questions on issues like that. These are not you know, the type one crimes, but certainly a concern for the community. When you do have incidents like that that are reported, do you have the opportunity to go back and look at video? Do you look at video for any types of crimes that happen on Metro?
We do. So with the 7K, the video only retains for a finite period of time. So it's important that that's reported timely. As long as we have that report within 24 hours, we can pull all that video from the 7K. We rely on that 7K video. It's phenomenal what it can do. And in that particular case, I could research it. But if we were made aware of it, we would have pulled the video.
And how long is the video preserved?
It depends on how many times the train cycles, but any given day, the best case scenario is about 72 hours on the 7K.
72 hours?
Correct.
Okay. Do you coordinate with other law enforcement organizations around the area? For example, you know, that same day, there was video of the persons that committed the crime using credit cards and things at other places. And there's been some coordination with your department on this, but how do you coordinate with the other jurisdictions around here when to investigate a crime like this?
We do in different aspects. Here in the city, we participate in a daily call at 1 o'clock every day. That's more youth-focused and crimes that are occurring in and around metro stations that are school-related. As far as the daily intelligence sharing, we share our crime report with the jurisdictions, and they share their crime report with us. And then we have people embedded with the respective police departments to show, hey, we had a trend last night of this. When we develop a BOLO, Be on the Lookout poster, we share that through the National Capital Region WARTAC, which is the fusion center for the region. We share it with MCAC, and we share it with Fairfax, so the Need to Know newsletter. So we do that daily.
And a final question. This particular crime, this seemed to be like teamwork that was planned out to basically prey on WMATA customers. How common is this? Are there people that actually make a living doing the same thing over and over again on the WMATA customers?
We've definitely come across the same individuals more than once who've committed crimes on to or against Metro or Metro customers. So it does happen, and those are the type of cases where we look for an opportunity not to use the privilege of using Metro. It's kind of like the Motor Vehicle Administration. If you commit X amount of offenses, you don't have the privilege to drive a motor vehicle, and that's something, we're always looking at.
And I guess recently we've seen that some of these individuals are also related to fare evasion crimes, this type of thing.
Yeah, I wouldn't say everybody who fare evades is a criminal, but when you go back and look at cases, a lot of criminals fare evade. So when you look at the 700-something arrests we've made, over 50% for fare evasion, they've had other charges, open warrants. It's amazing how many, you stop to have an open warrant, or they're wanted for some other matter or questioning. So fare evasion definitely is a tool that's used for law enforcement.
Well, thank you for the good work you're doing, and hopefully we'll have continuous improvement as we move forward. Thanks.
Thank you. Mr. Folger.
Well, thanks, Madam Chairman. Thanks, Chief. I'd be remiss if I didn't ask the question that was in the Washington Post editorial section this morning. I don't know if you had a chance to observe their recommendations about penalties and barring people who commit crimes, albeit minimal crimes, but they should be much different, I think. And barring that these folks from traveling on the same route or bus route, or for that matter, they can't travel anywhere on the system. They should be barred completely, in my opinion. But the hideous crime of this woman did to one of our bus drivers. Are we going to pursue in the future trying to make these crimes have higher value or higher impact?
And I'll defer a little bit to Ms. Lee sitting behind you, but we are always looking for that partnership with our jurisdiction partners. Other transit properties, obviously this caused me to make some phone calls and look at what other jurisdictions do or transit properties do. It's not uncommon to bar people, and the authority has that ability to bar people. So how we go about that is kind of a mechanical question, and I'll ask Ms. Lee if she wanted to make a comment about it.
Well, you can get back to us on,
That's fine.
Thank you very much, Chief Kath. I think we've run out of time.
I just want to follow up on Mr. Laube's question. I'm doing that a lot today, but Chief, in the case of these nonviolent crimes, what's your advice to the victim of crime? Is there a hotline they should call? Should they report it to an officer?
Excuse me. I'm doing so because there's another meeting that has to go on here, and we've run out of time on that.
I understand, I think we ought to, in light of Mr. Laube's question, just get the Chief's guidance to our riders as to what they should do in these nonviolent situations.
I think we can provide that information offline. Okay. Thank you. All right. Thank you. I'm sorry, but we do have to adjourn the meeting so that we can move on to the others. And there is the other data that's part of the report on in our package here.
Correct.
Thank you. Thank you. All those, I move that we adjourn right now.
Right.